Is that good? Yes, that's what I mean. Good evening. Before the evening's Doug Wright Awards get underway, I would like to, on behalf of the festival, first thank our sponsors who have been very generous in supporting what we've tried to make a very easily accessible, very inexpensive festival for everyone to attend. First of all, Scholastic, who were kind enough to bring Jeff Smith up for us and sponsor the children's tab. Sponsors that many of you in the industry will be aware of. Westcam, who helped with our posters, and Quebecor, who helped with the free comic book day book. I've got a lot of money. I'd like to thank all of the publishers who brought artists up with them to exhibit at their booth, even some publishers who couldn't make it themselves, who send people. The Silver Snail, another retailer here in Toronto, who was kind enough to bring up Paul Pope. Our government sponsors, both the Toronto Arts Council and the Ontario Arts Council. Owl Magazine, Now Magazine, who is our media sponsor, Ed Mervish Enterprises, all of you from out of town now know Honest Ed's from having walked by it all day, but they were very generous in the use of the parking lot and many other resources, and the merchants of Mervish Village and the surrounding areas who tolerated our imposition and the closing of the street tomorrow. I hope you'll all manage to eat at least one of the restaurants during your stay here. I also want to let people know what's going on for the rest of the evening. After the presentation for the Wright Awards tonight, in this room, are two international guests, Tobias and Stefan, whose Dutch last names I'm not trying right now, were the cartoonists behind Island, which many have likened to Europe's answer to Chris Ware, a very formally innovative cartooning pair. That you may have seen at some other U.S. shows, but this is their first time to Canada. Following that, Phoebe Glockner is going to be giving a reading. She was one of our guests at the festival last year and enjoyed it so much, and the feedback was so positive from her presentation here that she wanted to come back. So that's going on right where you are. If you're just looking to socialize for the rest of the evening, there is a party at Rocco's right up the street at the opposite corner from 9-ish onwards. It's a cash bar. Your wristbands or your guest credentials will get you in there. Anyone else, I think, is $10 at the door. All proceeds going to help there be another festival next year. Now I'd like to pass things over to Brad.
Hello, and welcome to the inaugural edition of the Doug Wright Awards. Kind of figured it out. That's Doug Wright right there. Who's with us? Quite nice. This is an award to honor Canadian cartooning. First of all, I should introduce myself. I'm Brad McKay. I'm a journalist and writer and kind of the unofficial comic scribe for CBC Arts Online. And I'll be your host for the evening. I'm extremely pleased that there's so many people here tonight. But I have to confess, when the organizing committee for the Wrights started thinking about getting a Canadian Comic Book Award together about 2003, actually, after TCAF, the last TCAF, there was something about it, to me anyways, that seemed a little off, that didn't seem right. Because when you think about it, cartoonists are kind of solitary creatures, people who spend, men and women, who spend a lot of their times hunched over drawing tables, panel size, and nib length, and some even resort to building fictional cities out of cardboard in their basement. Escape the monotony of their lives. But so the idea of getting all these people together in one room seemed kind of improbable and maybe even a little ill-advised. And then there's the whole issue of kind of the Canadian identity. I think as a country, we suffer from a bit of a collective aversion to anything that smacks of U.S.-style competition, especially when it comes to the arts. You've got, like, the Genies and the Geos and, like, the Killers, but I started thinking you could probably spend 20 minutes just listing off the awards in America for everything from music videos to stunt work to, like, video game designers. And it all seemed not particularly Canadian. But then I started thinking about it a bit, and I've done a fair deal of research on the history of Canadian cartooning, and I started thinking about the history of Canadian comics stretching back to the likes of J.W. Van Gogh at the turn of the century, to R. Taylor, who ended up working at the New York Magazine, an amazing cartoonist, to the Canadian Whites during World War II. And I started thinking about the 1980s, and Dave Sims Cerebus, who's here, actually, which is nice to see, to the comic boom of the 1990s with Julie Doucette, Seth, David Collier, Chester Brown. And then I started thinking, I was writing an article recently, I thought Louis Riel sold close to 20,000 copies in hardcover, which, when you think about it, is amazing for even like a normal novelist, much less a graphic novelist. And that's when I kind of felt a little appalled and kind of shocked that no one had thought of recognizing these unique artists in such a way. Out in the studio, in the open, in a way that would let the rest of Canada and the world enjoy what some of us already knew, which is that this country has a world-class community of cartoonists who are producing work that is really stellar and world-class. So that's why we're here. That's why I'm here. And that's probably as close to a nationalistic rant as I'll ever, ever say in public. I'm going to move on to the really boring stuff now before I introduce Seth. I'd just like to acknowledge everybody that's helped out with this over the past 5 months. You know, when award shows, people say, like, it took, you know, an enormous amount of time and effort. I always find that dubious, but it ends up the right, because over the past 5 months, there's been an enormous amount of planning and conniving prizes out of people, and there's been an enormous amount of people who've helped out along the way. I'd like to thank Peter and Chris, wherever they are. They're not here. For the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, for giving us the venue and helping out along the way. I also like to thank Alan Hunt, who may or not be here, who designed our fine logo, which is right up there. We just kind of drawn from Gutwright's work. Seth, I would like to thank for designing the trophy and many other invaluable wishes right here, which is, if you get to see later, which is an amazing piece of work. Brian Munn, who's been invaluable. He helped design the site and too many things to mention, quite frankly. G here, who was on the nomination committee and did so many other amazing things. Chester Brown, who was on the jury and drew a piece of art, actually, for our, if you haven't seen it already, for our raffle. And the jury as well. Nora Young from the CDC, who was on it. Rebecca Caldwell from the Globe and Mail Books Reporter, Chester Brown, Jerry Ciccariti, who's a director, and Don McKellar, who's here tonight, and we'll say a few words later. As well, our sponsors, the Victory Cafe for the space, Butler's Pantry, who hosted her. I think they were a little confused that people were giving an award for comics, quite frankly, but up the street, the Butler's Pantry, scratching their head. We were there. They also hosted our archery night, paid for the meal that night. As far as the raffle goes, Drawn and Quarterly Books, Fantagraphic Books, Dorling and Kindersley Books, Scholastic Books, Beguiling, HB Fan, Magic Pony, and of course Chester and Seth for the art. As well. Is that for me just for running off through that?
We wanted you to take a breath, Brad.
Thank you. As well, I'm happy to announce that Westcan Printing Group, which is a great printing company in Winnipeg, has donated I think it's going to be for every year of the awards, and I might get more next year, but $500 bursary for the winner of the Best Emerging Talent Award to help print, like any future printing job, comic or many invitations. I have no idea what you want to do, but that's it. So thanks to them, because that was really great. And I swear to God, this is almost over. Volunteers, all the TCAP volunteers who helped out today, moving chairs, especially Jeet, who was running around with us, Solly, who drove us around, my friend Jeff, who's down from Ottawa, Brenda, Brian, Kara, and of course, the Wright family, who is here. It's been amazing. Because I'm working on a book about Doug Wright as well. It's kind of lingering in the background. And she's been great. We've, like, she, you know, she didn't even know us. And she, like, brought us into her house, let us question her, and, like, let us run through her boxes of art in the basement. I really didn't have to do that. She didn't know us from anything. As well, she allowed us to lend her late husband's name to be Ward, which I think is fantastic. She didn't do that either. So Phyllis is here. You want to say hi? Phyllis and the family also loaned us the art. Again, they loaned us the art. It's very nice. Which is all around the sides, as you can see. It's kind of hard to see now because we're all sitting down, but it's going to be up for the weekend. And this is just kind of a sampling of Doug Wright's art from over the years. A small sampling, but a sampling. So you can check that out and see how great his stuff is. So that is great. And lastly, this is really self-indulgent, but I'd like to thank my wife and Clara, who's at the back, who, if you know anybody who likes... I there they are. They're right back there. And she's telling me she can't hear me. If you know anybody who likes comics, or you're married to anyone who likes comics, you probably hate comics. Like, you're probably sick of hearing them. So that's the kind of like the normal, that's like the normal sea level for Aaron. But the past 5 months, I was even irritated after a while listening to myself talk about, you know, and this was amazing, and blah, 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 and this book, you should read it. And I don't, like, I really don't think once, she probably zoned out, but I don't think once she actually like told me to shut up, which is a feat in and of itself. And if it was a trophy, it, hello, Clara. Anyways, so it was pretty insufferable, but you put up with it, and I thank you. So that's it. I'm going to give you the meat of the evening, as it were, which is Seth, who is going to produce a slideshow and his thoughts on the man whose name we're all here to honor, which is Doug. Thanks.
Can you hear me okay on this?
Yeah.
Is that all right? When the idea of a new Canadian award for cartooning came along, there were really only two names that immediately presented themselves as possible namesakes, Jimmy Freeze and Doug Wright. I'm not entirely sure why Freeze lost out. I don't recall any debate on the matter. Hands down, it was Wright. It's just possible that Wright is more a part of our world than Freeze. Freeze was born in the 19th century and was dead by 1948. He was simply a more distant figure. Whatever the reasoning, it's no slight to either man. They were both enormously talented. They were the twin pillars of Canada's cartooning history before 1980. Still, I'd venture a guess that neither name is overly familiar to many of you here tonight. Canada has a short memory for its own creative people. That's why I've been asked to come up here and give some information about Doug Wright to those of you who may not know of him or his work. To prepare this talk, I dug out all the material I had on Mr. Wright. 20 years of painfully difficult collecting. It's been an uphill battle to find his work. Nothing remains in print. Very few book collections were ever printed to begin with. Each individual strip had to be found in magazines gleaned from yard sales and church basements and Goodwills. Magazine dealers don't carry these kind of magazines very often, nor do comic shops. Each strip found was a triumph. Anyhow, I looked through all this stuff. I even looked through a box of strips lent to me by Mr. White's widow, Phyllis. It was there in that box of fading newsprint that I came across a single yellowed sheet of typewritten copy, an artist bio, obviously typed out by Wright himself, possibly to include with submissions, or maybe to hand out to the press. Here's what he wrote. Quote, Doug Wright was born in England and arrived in Canada at the age of 21 with a sister and a mother who longed to see him become a doctor. Stationed at Rivers, Manitoba during the war, he became a cartoonist by accident when fellow Air Force recruits began laughing at his doodlings. A cartoon strip, Doug Wright's Family, based on the doings in his own household and the neighborhood, and a cartoon depicting the average man's preoccupation with potholes, taxes, and other mundane problems, were published in Canada and syndicated all over the globe. One doesn't find politicians and public figures in Wright's work, but in the sense that this artist deals with the dilemma of people in a troubled society, he is political. Like many successful cartoonists, doing both editorial and comic art, Doug Wright began as a ghost, helping the late Jimmy Freeze with the strip Juniper Junction, then stepped out to try several features of his own. The thing about this profession is, it's creative and rewarding, says Wright. After all, in what other line, if a taxi driver cuts me off, could I get even with him in a drawing? End quote. Like most cartoonists, when forced to sit down and write about themselves and their work, Wright seems to have missed the point entirely. He didn't get to the heart of it at all. He's just trying to sound professional here, businesslike. He even ends it with a joke, like a good business speech. He brings up the political stuff to sound serious. If anything, he sounds a bit embarrassed. I even think he cribbed the middle part from John Muir's introduction to Wright's collection of Spectator cartoons. Even the typing looks pained, with its careful borders and many whited-out errors. Doug left out all the poetry. But since Wright started with the dry stuff, I'll start with the dry stuff. Wright was born in 1917 in England. His father died in the war before Doug even met him. He came to Canada at the age of 18 to work as a commercial artist for the Sun Life Assurance Company. When the Second World War came along, he joined the RCAF, and that's where he had his first cartoons published, in the Station magazine. The positive attention by those airmen changed his life. He was now a cartoonist. After the war, he went to New York to try and break in, but lucky for Canada, they sent him back home to get some experience. In 1948, he started a little strip about a toddler for the Montreal Standard magazine. A contest named the kid Nipper, a name Wright never cared much for. In 1967, he switched magazines and changed the strip's name to Doug Wright's Family. Wright married Phyllis in 1952, and over the next 8 years, they had three children. Three boys who would supply him with the raw material he would need to churn out a weekly strip for over 30 years. Back in 1948, he had also taken over Jimmy Freeze's strip, Juniper Junction, when Jimmy died. He drew this strip in the Family Herald magazine up until 1968, when the magazine folded. On top of these two strips, he drew large, single-panel cartoons for the Montreal Star, and later the Hamilton Spectator, and lots of illustrations, too. Complicated illustrations, with scores of figures and highly detailed backgrounds. He tried to syndicate two other strips during those years also. They didn't pan out. So you can see, Wright was a hard worker, a real professional. He slaved his life away in that studio, as all real cartoonists do. A lot of time alone at the drawing board. But don't let that be his whole epitaph. There's a lot about him that appears between the lines of that bio. I don't know about the real stuff. I never knew the man. But I know the work, and there is some poetry in the work. Now, from all I know about the man, Wright was humble and not given much to pretensions, so I'm sure he'd shudder at any mention of poetry in connection to his work. Still, for a comic strip without any words, he did manage to get some quite a bit of poetry in there, a kind of poem to suburbia, or to the middle-class lifestyle. Even though by the time I was reading the strip, it was titled Doug Wright's Family, it was never known as anything but Nipper in my house. I remember wondering why my mother called it this, but oddly, I never asked. I just took her word for it. His name was Nipper. Both the magazines the strip had appeared in were newspaper supplements. They came with the weekend paper. A huge section of the Canadian public read the strip. These magazines were predominantly middle-brow in content and were pretty reflective of Canadian culture at the time. They had articles on hockey players and the Queen, Madame Benoit's recipes, and lots of ads for curling sweaters and Kraft cheeses. Like all magazines of the time, They like to have a little cartoon in the back to give the reader something to chuckle at, something wholesome and family-friendly. If they had picked someone else to do it, someone less talented and dedicated than Wright, then the strips would probably have been forgettable. The fact that we are here tonight shows that something in the strip turned out to be memorable. And a lot of people do fondly remember the strip. But, like Wright's son Ken once said to me, 40 is the dividing line. Over 40 and they remember, under 40 and they don't. There is some truth to that. However, even those over 40 often misremember the strip. Often it is recalled as a sort of Canadian family circus. This irritates me. Wright's work had none of the flavor of that south of the border baby strip. In fact, his view of childhood was remarkably matter-of-fact, downright unsentimental. Rather than showing childhood as precious, he tended to focus on the petty conflicts between children. There was a lot of minor bullying in the strip. Nipper and his unnamed little brother were constantly at each other. Wright wasn't looking back with rose-colored glasses. He was looking outside his window for something real. That probably says a lot about Wright. It was a pantomime strip, told only with pictures. This is a fact that people often forget. That's a real testament to his storytelling skills. His strips were so well executed that you don't notice the lack of words. I bet there were readers who never noticed. The most recognizable feature of the comic was the two distinctive bald heads of the boys. In 1950, Wright had designed their round heads to emulate the buzz cuts that were popular at the time. However, by the 1970s, the boys stood out oddly among their long-haired friends. Younger readers always ask, why are those kids bald? I've read that Wright would have liked to have updated his boys to give them 70s hair, but he knew that the readers would be perplexed by the change. Thank God he resisted. Now they can safely enter that pantheon of inexplicably bald cartoon children. The Yellow Kid, Henry, Barnaby, Herbie, Sluggo, and of course good old Charlie Brown. For the first decade, Wright's drawing was minimalist, focused on the figures. Backgrounds in the strips were sparse, often non-existent. However, by the 60s, his work had flourished. His interest turned to those backgrounds, and now they were richly detailed. This love of detail was always there in his illustrations, but not so much in his cartoons. It was in this period that his amazing abilities as a draftsman came to the fore. He often spent an entire day working out the complex settings for his cartoons in the Montreal Star and later the Hamilton Spectator. This attention to detail found its way into the comic strips, too. The panels became masterfully crafted examples of deep space and careful observation. In one memorable panel, he drew a large, complicated vista of a strip mall, the parking lot, the street, and the hills beyond, which perfectly captured the essence of just such a mid-20th century location. Looking at this drawing is practically the same as visiting the place. As his backgrounds grew in complexity, so did their sense of exactness. The environment of the strip was, undoubtedly, his own house, his own neighborhood, and his own town. Wright was drawing the very world that I grew up in, the southwestern Ontario of the 60s and 70s. Every carefully rendered detail is perfectly familiar to me. The ranch-style homes, the schoolyards, the corner stores, even the little things like the screen doors. Wright's cartoons are like a catalog of that period, the clothes, the hairstyles, the furnishings, the streets, and especially the cars. Wright obviously loved cars. He lavished special care in the drawing of them, and it shows. He rendered them with both utter authenticity and a kind of vital inner life. They jumped off the page. Every kind of vehicle was lovingly drawn. Go-karts, race cars, station wagons, muscle cars, fire engines, even the garbage trucks. The boys themselves were always tooling around in their famous hot rod pedal cars. A lot of the cartoonists of the mid-20th century were fascinated by the machines of progress, but usually this manifested itself in a love of airplanes. Wright is the only one I know that picked the automobile. It's no surprise that when Wright took over Freeze's Juniper Junction, the focus of the strip rapidly narrowed from that of the various residents of the little town to just that of the town's garage and its mechanics. Earlier, I used the term sense of exactness to describe Wright's drawings. That sense was never more acute than in his drawings of post-war suburban environment. They evoke the very experience of being there. I can think of nothing else, not even photographs, that bring that world of my childhood back to me with such deeply felt longing. As I peer into his strips, I see the essence of an era that no longer exists, the last breath of the early 20th century mixing with the new world that is to come. On occasion, Wright would focus his great rendering skills on a small poetic moment of everyday life, such as a snowy winter morning, or a dusky evening of fireworks, or a sudden sunshine. These images never drew undue attention to themselves. They never slowed the strips down. Still, if you stopped and took the time to take them in, you would feel their subtle beauty. This brings up another of Wright's gifts, his wonderful ability to draw weather. He's one of the very few cartoonists who can actually make you feel the temperature in a comic strip. His sensitivity to weather was as integral to his work as his interest in detail. Sometimes it seemed as if the comic was as much about place and atmosphere as it was about the family. But of course, the family was the actual content of the strips. On the surface, Doug Wright's family seems to be a series of domestic gags. But it doesn't seem right to label his work a gag strip, because he never seemed to have really aimed for the big laugh. It was more observational, more slice of life. Wright's work played the chords of familiarity. He let you in on the small events that you would recognize from your own family life. Don't get me wrong, the strip was humorous, but it was a wry humor. It was the frustration of dealing with a little boy who keeps slamming the screen door so often that no matter how many times you tell him to cut it out, he just keeps doing it. Or the childish embarrassment of an unexpected kiss from an adult. Or the difficulties of trying to fly your kid's toy plane. Each situation, hundreds of them, was played perfectly deadpan. It was a simple record of the duties, quibbles, irritations, and pleasures of family life. Once a year, the magazine would give him an entire page of full color. For a Christmas strip. Even these strips were never sentimental. They tended to stress the petty greed of childhood, or perhaps a social embarrassment, or other less typical Christmas themes. For someone like myself, who tends towards sentimentality, I've always been impressed by Wright's ability to steer clear of this minefield, especially in a kid-focused strip. I've heard it said that having children of your own puts an end to any ideas of romanticized childhood. As the 60s and 70s passed, Wright watched the societal changes with a bemused attitude. Even though ostensibly he was the father in the strip, Wright the artist always seemed to be an observer, uninvolved, detached. He never seemed bothered by the changes in society. If anything, he continued to find humor in them. He loved to gently mock the youth culture of the time, especially in his big single-panel cartoons for the Hamilton Spectator. In his comic strip, the work became more and more focused on tiny events, the amusement of blowing up a balloon or getting stuck in a tree, whether the cat should be in or out of the house. I've noticed in the very late 70s that his work began to dry up. He started to recycle some old gags that he'd used back in the early 50s. Sadly, these were drawn with less vigor and skill, and they compare badly with the earlier ones. I had wondered about this decline when I first studied those cartoons, but I've since learned he suffered a small stroke around this time. Being a cartoonist myself, I can understand that imposing dread of the work looming. There's always some deadline coming down the pipeline, ideas needed. He must have felt his abilities slipping away from him, his great drawing powers weakening. The drawings are weaker at the very end. I think I can imagine some of that disappointment he must have felt sitting in that studio, that man who had prided himself so much on his amazing creative abilities. And so the strip came to an end in 1980. I can only guess at his thoughts and feelings on the matter. He'd drawn it for 32 years. As always, truth is stranger than fiction. On the day the last strip appeared, Doug Wright had the big stroke that closed off that amazing drawing ability forever. Wright himself was dead within 3 years. And since then, like so many artists who worked in the popular press, His name has grown dimmer with the passing of time. He's in danger of being forgotten. That's what brings us here tonight. Yes, these awards are here to honor the artists of today, but I'm hoping that the Wright Awards will help bring men like Doug Wright back again. Artists like Jimmy Fries, Walter Ball, James Simpkins, Albert Chartier, Peter Wally. These men were the hard-working cartoonists of Canada's past. They stayed in Canada and published through the magazines and newspapers of their time. Canada's publishing industry was small, and they had to struggle to make a living. But they were hard workers, and their work changed the country. They were part of the generations that defined Canada's identity and its fledgling pop culture. I know these men never thought of themselves collectively. They were each individual commercial artists working alone. They probably didn't think of themselves as cartoonists with a big C. If anything, they probably identified with the newspaper men, art directors, and publishers they worked with. Still, I'd like to bring them into the fold, to welcome them in after their long years in the wilderness. I'm hoping that Doug Wright would have been happy to see that all these years later, his work lives on, and that young artists, who weren't even born during the years he was working, will know his name. Thank you. Now I'd like to welcome Doug's son, Jim, up to say a few words on behalf of the family.
Wow, how do I follow that? I thought about this, and I thought I could give some dry stuff like Seth started with, about background and all that stuff. I think what might be more interesting is couple of things about growing up with your father as a very well-known cartoonist. One being, I remember coming home every day, or every Monday, come home from school, and he spent the day Monday doing the Nipper or Doug Wright's family strip. And the first thing I do, and I'm sure Ken and Bill did the same thing, when I got home was go up to his office and look at the strip. And I'd look forward to that every Monday, and then it would appear 8 weeks later in the Canadian magazine. One of the other things about growing up with the father's a cartoonist, as I got older and understood what he did, I could present ideas. And I remember one particular idea where we were playing, I was like maybe 12, and we were just playing taco football with no pads in the neighbor's lawn. It was the summer. And we all took a drink and left the hose on. And somebody got tackled in the water from the hose. I came home and told him that. And lo and behold, a week later, there it was on the Monday afternoon. And that was cool. The other thing, and this kind of ties in with what I want to say to Brad and Seth and all the people behind the scenes that have done this, we really appreciate it. Because when I was a kid, I told no one what my father did. Because all you heard was Nipper, Nipper, and all that crap. So I tell nobody. And then, as Seth has said, as time has passed, I say to people, in the course of conversation, people ask family and stuff, and you say, well, my father was Doug Wright. You remember that cartoonist? No. It's always no. Even that dividing line, 40, it's no all the time. So this is really nice. And I hope it lives on, and I'm sure Dad would be very pleased to see this. Thank you very much.
Before I forget, I didn't introduce the other sons who are here as well. We've got Bill, right, as well. And the baby of the family, Ken. And I would introduce the rest, but they're all right here. Many grandkids who unfortunately never met Doug Wright. So this is, I would hope, a bit of an interesting way to see your grandfather up there, isn't it? I'm going to move on. I'm just going to take a moment now to describe the process before we get to actually announcing the awards. From the beginning, we decided that the Wright Awards would be focused on completed works by cartoonists. And for the uninitiated, what I mean by that is creators who both write and draw the comics, as opposed to people who say are just exclusively inkers or editors, etc. So back in March, a nomination committee combed through a long list of comics and graphic novels published from January 2004 to December 2004. I might add that it was about, well, 6 months before then that we enlisted Seth to design these amazing trophies that hopefully you'll get to see at some point. Long before, and then somewhere along the line, his book popped up on the nomination list. So maybe the first time that somebody's designed a trophy, they can actually win. But who knew? But that, anyways, that's nothing that you could have foretold. But it's a unique situation, regardless. Then the long list of books, again, all by Canadian cartoonists, were divided up into a short list, either best book category or best emerging talent, to recognize both established creators and up-and-coming artists. After the short list was voted on by the committee to get a short list, which I will get to in a second, the nominated books were delivered to a jury of five, which was kind of hand-picked from a wide variety of the arts community. It included one cartoonist, which you vote every year, hopefully one of the two winners from tonight, which we'll talk about later. Chester Brown, Luria, who's on the jury. Jerry Chikariti, who unfortunately apparently has pneumonia and can't be here tonight. He's the director of the Trudeau miniseries on the Lives of the Saints and a very avid comic fan. A radio broadcaster in Reddit, Nora Young, who unfortunately couldn't be here from CBC. A print journalist, the Globe's Rebecca Caldwell, who is the books reporter for the Globe, who is in Israel. An actor, director, playwright, writer, Don McKellar, who is thankfully here with us. Each of them brought their own strengths to the table, and as the moderator for the jury dinner, which happened a couple of months ago, I was really kind of stunned with and amazed and in awe of their depth of knowledge of comics. We picked people we figured would have some sense, would know, like, Louis Riel, maybe Palookaville, maybe some other stuff, but yeah, people were, on the whole, had a depth of knowledge that I didn't even know existed, quite frankly, of some of the creators, which is fantastic. And as well, they tackled their duties with utter seriousness, which I extremely appreciate, and came with tons of notes, and et cetera, et cetera. Needless to say, the jury dinner was a blast. It was a lot of fun. And I'd like to invite Don up, actually, to say a few words about that experience.
Well, I didn't know I was coming up here. Jerry got sick, and if I knew I was coming up, I would have prepared an amusing speech and dressed a little better if I knew I was sharing a podium with Seth. But it's hard for me to talk about the jury process without tipping my hand. I will say that, as Brad said, it was very enthusiastic discussion. And the jury, we were very pleased with the quality of the books that selected. And people came with different degrees of knowledge and acquaintance with the work. But everyone took it very seriously, like you say. Not too seriously. But yeah, some people did bring notes and reference material, and still, I think it's safe to say. I think it's safe to, also, I should say that I believe every book was championed by someone at some point. It was because the books are very diverse, anyone who knows the material, and will know that, you know, they're not, you're going to get different opinions, different tastes are going to be catered to, and yeah, so it was tough. But after a couple of bottles of wine, I think we were all happy with the results, and I don't think anyone felt compromised. Isn't that safe to say?
Yes.
Yes.
Except me. I was compromised.
You were compromised, but that's another story that had to do with those bottles of wine.
So
one thing we were all very happy with, certainly, was the awards themselves, which not only because we got free copies of all the books, which we didn't even know when we agreed to do it, but also just the idea of the awards. Certainly, speaking for myself, I've been a long time inspired by and very proud of the Canadian comic book scene. And so I think even as American as it is, it's very nice that they're recognized. And also, it's great that they're called the Doug Wright Awards. I mean, I just find it, just seeing those again, I just find it shocking and a little disturbing how much I remember. I remember the father's hairy legs so well. So I guess that says something about that dividing line and me, which must be wrong. That's all I can say. Anyway, now do I pass it back to you, Brad?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here you go.
So now I'd like to go over the nominees for Best Emerging Talent. First up is Brian Lee O'Malley's Scott Pilgrim Volume 1. A pretty tiny photo, but Brian Lee O'Malley is a 26-year-old Ontario-born cartoonist who recently relocated to Halifax, Nova Scotia, whose breakout book combines a Japanese manga, indie rock, and video game nostalgia to a fun and surprisingly touching read. His 23-year-old protagonist, which is him, Scott Pilgrim, kind of sums up the self-centeredness and confusion that goes along with being young and possibly in love. The first of a 6-volume series, the second of which debuted today, correct? Was recently optioned for the big screen by Universal Pictures.
Correct.
So congratulations to Brian Lee O'Malley, who was right there. Number two is Canvas by Alex Fellows. It's much bigger. I don't know why that happened. Beautiful cover. Is Alex Fellows here? Tick, tick. Come up here and sit down in your seat. It's chosen for you, Alex Fellows. Hiding all the way back there. It's unfortunate. Canvas, which is published by Fantagraphics Books in the States, tells the slightly bent coming-of-age story of Canvas, a 14-year-old girl starting to make her way through a world of sex, booze, and boys. It's the first book by Fellows, this 26-year-old fine arts graduate living in Montreal, and it's a great read. Move on to Max Douglas, or Sal Goodsam, which is his pen name, for Revolver Number 1. It's the first issue of a very personal anthology of short stories and a words and poetry combination by Sal Goodsam, who is also Montreal and Max Douglas, who goes by two names. It's very interesting. He's sitting right here, dressed to the nines, which is fantastic. Douglas is it fair to say, a veteran artist? Been around for a while. With various mainstream comic book companies, done a lot of work. But he's decided to use Revolver as an avenue for his creative id and a showcase for his beautiful art inside. Moving on to Rebecca Dart, who is not here, unfortunately, because she lives in Vancouver. But her book, which is nominated, is Rabbit Head, which is published by Alternative Press. Rabbit Head is an ambitious and audacious comic. It tells the odyssey of its main character, Rabbit Head, via 7 interwoven narratives. Inspired by a 1965 Polish film called the Sargasso Manuscript, the wordless tale is an intriguing and emotional journey. This is the first published comic from Dart, who's a 32-year-old living in Vancouver, where she works full-time as an animator. And now, I'd like to bring Phyllis up.
Okay. Okay, Scott Pilgrim.
Of Mark Bell's new series, which follows the adventures of characters that could only be cooked up by the mind of this veteran cartoonist. They include Monsieur Mustache, Miss Polly, Mr. Socks, Ingo Bango Man, and Wilder Hobson. And I have to say, during the jury meeting, inexplicably, Nora Young could not stop laughing about this book. Bell's surreal cartoony dream logic led Time magazine to recently compare him to the king of U.S. surreal comics, Jim Woodring. Anyways, there it is. Next up. Next up is Geneviève Castries' Pamplemousse by Louis de Crevin. Pamplemousse is Castries' 12x12-inch tour de force. It's an oversized comic narrative that illustrates an album of the artist's own unique lyrical songs. Boasting a style that can be, I think, favorably compared to Julie Doucet, Pamplemousse places Castries, who lives in Vancouver, you know, I met this week and flew back, unfortunately, firmly on the cutting edge of Canadian comics. Pamplemousse. Next up is Clyde Fan's Book One by Seth. Published by Drawn and Quarterly, Clyde Fan's tells the story of Simon and Abraham Matchcard, two brothers involved in a fan business in Toronto. The first part of this ambitious graphic novel from Guelph, Ontario's own Seth follows one brother in the present day as he reflects on his life as a salesman, then shifts in time to tell the tale of Simon as he pursues his ill-fated sales career. Clyde Fan's finds Seth at the peak of his storytelling abilities, with his sleek line adding to the beauty of the story. Clyde Fan's. David Collier's Frank Ritzavavis. Because David Collier isn't here either, is he? No. I was hoping he would be here, but he's not. David Collier's Frank Ritzavavis by Drawn and Quarterly. Collier's latest book takes the reader back into the always surprising mind of a true Canadian eccentric. Ritza follows Collier as he explores his memories of living alone on a family farm, enlisting in the army, and his eventual discovery of an obscure artist named Frank Ritza. Interspersed with excerpts from his always surprising and copious sketchbooks, Frank Ritza is as unique as Canadian comics can get. Frank Ritza! Next up is The New Frontier, Volume 1 by Darwin Cook. I think somewhere out there, and I've never met. Why aren't you sitting up here? Nobody told you. I'm sorry. Nice to meet you. The New Frontier is an ambitious retelling and reimagining of classic superheroes from DC Comics' Silver Age of the 1960s. Part unabashed nostalgia trip and part social commentary, the book features Superman as a U.S. government operative and Wonder Woman as a radical loose cannon. Cook lends his lush art, honed on the retro-styled Catwoman series, to a story that is both thoughtful and a blast to read. The envelope, please. I just wanted to say that.
I need my glasses this time.
Unless you want me to whisper in your ear. Is that good? Do you want me to do that as well? Well, that's made my wife
jealous. Oh, I'm sure.
So the winner of the inaugural Best Book Award for the Dobrite Award. Sorry, can you read that?
Yes, I can read that. I don't even need my glasses. Clyde Fans, Book 1.
First, I'd like to say I'm mortified to win this award. I have far too much involvement in this. But I have to swear to you that there is a law in these awards that the artist cannot vote for themselves. So I did not vote for myself in any way for this. But I am extremely honored. I'm always proud to be a Canadian. It makes up so much of what my work is about. And to be... given an award in Canada is so much more meaningful than the American awards. And I'd like to thank Chris Oliveros first, my publisher, who supported me all through the years, who published my first comic, which was terrible, and still continued to publish me after that. And I'd like to thank my best friend Chester Brown for his long years of support, always looking over my stuff and telling me how to make it better. And to my wife Tanya for... as Brad said, for her continued patience hearing about comics 24 hours a day, and for letting me sit in the basement for my entire life. Thank you very much.
So you may think this is over, but I'm afraid it's not. We also have a Hall of Fame, which I neglected to mention, that we're calling the Giants of the North, first inductee of which will be Doug Wright. And we're going to have Brian Munn come on up, who's a far better comics historian than I. And he's going to go over the four inductees and have a brief talk about each. And then...
sort of addendum to these awards, we've also inaugurated a Cartoonist Hall of Fame, Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame, which we've dubbed the Giants of the North, which is devoted to rewarding or acknowledging the contributions made by people who have made singular, lifelong contributions to the art of cartooning in Canada. It's just a brief history lesson. I'm going to start alphabetically with our first four inductees. This is J.W. Bengo, one of our earliest cartoonists. He lived from 1851 to 1923. He was one of one of our earliest caricaturists and publishers, too. He came to prominence in the late 1800s through the publication of Rip Magazine, a humorous weekly published in Toronto. In the style of the British Punch, or U.S. Judge, Rip lampooned the political and social culture of Canada for years following Confederation. Bengo's detailed, devastating cartooning dealt with the shenanigans of Prime Minister John A. Macdonald and the rebellion of Louis Riel, as well as with issues like women's rights, prohibition, and workers' rights. Considered by many to be the father of English language caricature in Canada, Bengo and Rip are hugely influential and deserve place in the history of Canadian cartooning, the true giant of the North. Next inductee, and continuing sort of chronologically, is Alberic Bourgeois, who lived from 1876 to 1962. Bourgeois is credited with creating the first continuing comic strip to use word balloons in Canada, what we all think of as a comic strip. Arguably the first similar comic strip to exist in the Francophone world at large. Born in Montreal, Bourgeois went to work for the daily newspaper La Patrie. There he created editorial cartoons, illustrations, and comic strips, including The Adventures of Timothy, an example of which is shown here, which debuted in January 1904. Timothy was a large-nosed little man, well-intentioned, but brutally misunderstood. In full-color strips, Bourgeois chronicled Timothy's series of misadventures, stumbling through a world that seemed to have a quintessentially, to have it in for him, a quintessentially modern perspective. Bourgeois is a giant of the North for creating Canada's first comic strip star. Our next cartoonist is Peter Wally. He was born in 1921. He's still with us, actually. Wally is one of the most iconoclastic and inventive cartoonists Canada's ever produced. Born in Brockville, Ontario, Wally began contributing illustrations and political cartoons to national publications beginning in the 1940s. He appeared in Maclean's, The Standard Weekend Magazine, and others through the 1950s and 60s. He produced several books with the writer Eric Nickel, including An Uninhibited History of Canada and 100 Years of What? In addition, Wally produced several solo collections of cartoons. He was an early self-publisher. And some of his books that he published include Hyperbole, Northern Blights, Flop, The Pornographics of Politics, and Man on the High Wire, which an illustration is shown here. Using a cartoony style, this giant of the North lambasted such Canadian sacred cows as the Group of Seven, the welfare state, and every conceivable aspect of politics. Wally's savage and cynical cartoons timelessly capture the hypocrisy, mediocrity, and just plain silliness that characterizes life in Canada. And lastly, and how could we not include Doug Wright in our first Hall of Fame? Doug Wright is the reason we're here tonight. I don't know what I can say to add to it, to what's been said tonight. But to tell you that we have lots of his cartoons available online on our on the website associated with these awards. And if you want to learn any more about any of these cartoonists and about the awards in general, please check us out.
I'm trying to remember the website address.
Yeah, the website address is, it doesn't make any sense, but it's...
just type in Doug Wright Awards.
Yeah, the Doug Wright Awards, you'll get there, or the Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And that's it, that's our Hall of Fame. Thank you very much.
It's funny because I had it on the raffle table, and people were like, how can I buy this? They thought it was like a new publication. Until our book comes down the pipe from Drawn and Quarterly about Doug Wright, you can find, I remember this book from a kid, there's two books of Doug Wright's family strips that, smiling, right now. You recognize them. But I remember as a kid, and you can find in many used bookstores and all over the place. There's this one, and there's a smaller one. So if you're interested in any of the stuff, that's all great. There's tons of it in here. Just keep an eye out for it if you're in a used bookstore. You'd be pleasantly surprised. There's a while I wanted to mention, which I failed to mention before. I talked to Peter Wally about a week ago, and unfortunately he lives just outside of Montreal, and he's going through a bout of bad health. But he's an extremely chipper guy, and he wanted to, he was quite taken aback, and he was quite honored, and he wanted to pass it on to everyone here. So, from Peter Wally to everyone, thank you. And then what else? I think that's it. I wanted to mention the raffle at the back. We've already been hounded by one of our wonderful volunteers about the raffle, which will help us pay for everything and the extremely fantastic awards, etc., etc. Will also be on sale all day tomorrow at TCAF, I believe outside of the Beguiling. There's tons. Pardon?
We'll have the draw outside the Beguiling.
Are we going to have the books outside the Beguiling too?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have the table set up outside the Beguiling like we had outside the tent. And the draw will be at 6 p.m. outside of the Beguiling with Cheat and myself. You don't have to be there to obviously win it, but if you want to come, please do. And that's it. Thanks for all coming. As I've been saying all day, I want to thank you all, truly friends of Canadian comics, which is my mantra for the day. And as well, I wanted to point out, did you want to talk about what's coming up next?
I'm going
to
do that.
Okay, great. I was going to do that, but you can. Thank you very much.
A much larger break was scheduled, but we started a little late, so there's just going to be maybe 4 or 5 minutes for people to refresh their drinks and use the washroom if they need to. And we have Mark Nevins here, who will be introducing Tobias and Stefan to the rest of you. And it's going to be a pretty exciting little presentation. That makes it a very interesting presentation. There's not a lot of action in this one, but a fascinating look at some of the most interesting comics out there. So, see you in 4 or 5 minutes.